Friends, slightly out of breath, a couple minutes late. I'm sure everybody's here, so I don't have to bother with the roll. You don't be impressed with this big book. Is there anybody not here? Mr. Hughes, are you here? Everybody's here. I'll get it in a minute. 5, 10, 13, 16, 20. 23, 27. Aye, aye. We're okay. Mrs. McAndrews is not here. She's 28. Oh, you're here?
Oh, you are here.
Guys, what's going on? Oh. Didn't see you, Mrs. McAndrews. We'll worry about it later. 7. 15, 18. Well, I guess I have 28. Forget it. I have 28. That's good. Shall we pray? We're thankful this morning, our Father, for your blessing to us and for your care. Thankful for this day. Pray you bless us in our studies and help us to be prospered, and that what we learn to do shall be for Christ. In his name we pray. Amen. Yes, a New Testament history, or New Testament survey. I was browsing with you about the New Testament and its broad historical backgrounds in our last thrilling and pleasant session. That's what I was doing in the last thrilling and pleasant session. And Dr. Cohen was a student of mine years ago. He came late to class every day. He's not here anymore, so I can say this without him getting irritated at me. He came late every day. He was not on time once. Naturally, when he became a teacher, he was a perfect charlatan on people being there on time. But when he was a student, he was never on time. So one morning he came in about 10 minutes late, looking sleepy and carrying a cup of coffee. And I said to him that I wished that he'd get to class on time so he wouldn't miss a single moment of any of my thrilling lectures. And he said, Mr. Taylor, he said, if you'll tell us in advance when they're going to be given, none of us will be given. Well, he used to say to me again and again, he said, I wish you'd forget that. I wish you'd get over that. But you don't get over things like that. So I remembered it and used it for years to keep him in a sense of proper humility or something like that, and in a sense of calmness. It worked very well, I think. I was talking with you about the Old Testament's historic background. I talked with you about the political background. I framed a chart in that particular thing. I talked with you a little bit about the cultural society launching into the various philosophies and passing by them as quickly as we could. And I want to chat with you for a few minutes this morning about the religious background, about the Hebrew or the Judaistic culture. And then we will be on to the New Testament in a proper sense. You always wonder when you're going to get to that. But about half the things you study in life are peripheral, and that's the advantage of seminary. In seminary, you can study them where you can't really do it almost any place else in the world. You squander that little bit of time for yourself. But in the religious background, I mentioned just two or three quick things. First of all, that the older religious systems, the gods of mythology, the mythological systems, were pretty much dying. Kenny notes that, Filson notes that, all the books note it, so I ought to note it too. If they all say it, I should say it. There were not many loyal and devout adherents any longer to the older gods. I don't know what you've done in school. Have any of you read Bullfinch, the Bullfinch's mythology, or any of those things? You know, there's some good things in life to read. I don't know how to get the time to read them all, but now the gods of Greece and Rome were at their best wicked rascals. At their very best, they were wicked rascals. They were creatures of the mind who were able to do all the things that people wanted to do and couldn't do and get away with it. So the gods of Greece and Rome were really the deification of desires, fleshly desires of men, and no doubt there was a time when a lot of people believed in them, because there always are things that people believe in. But by the time you come to the New Testament age, by and large, even those who worship and set out offerings to Diana and whatnot are purely trade types. That's what bothered them at Ephesus when Paul broke up the Diana worship. It wasn't the fact they worried about Diana, it was the fact that they wouldn't be able to sell the silver votaries anymore. So the ancient gods had become largely commercialized. Of course, the man in the street was always frightfully superstitious, still is. But when we talk about the religious background, the Grecian, Roman mythological gods and ideals, as well as the Egyptian, had pretty much no following. No serious following, right?
In the last class, you were talking about the decadence of the society as a whole, and it was quite rotten. I'm curious, to what extent did the religion participate to that? Because you said it was very, it was also a decadent.
It certainly did a lot to offer to it. When the god that you're named for is a guy who spends all his time figuring out clever ways to seduce women or to cheat men, and you're named for him, it certainly doesn't do much to give you a good moral example to follow. So the character of the Grecian and Roman gods certainly contributed a lot to the decadence of their society. The gods cheated all the time. Cheated, broke their words. Morality and truth. Of course, the philosophers like Plato and Aristotle never believed in the gods of mythology. They spoofed them all the time. One of the reasons that Socrates got to drink the bitter cup. He made fun of the godly ideals back in the 5th century B.C., fun of the godly ideals of the mythological gods, so they eliminated him. But the pagan gods did a lot to contribute to the decadence of society. They did an awful lot to contribute, because they set forth an ideal which had no moral or no ethical value to it, but they were pretty well gone. So I just merely mentioned that. You do have people crying about Diana, but it was more the commercial interests than the god interests. And you have a group of people look at Barnabas, and they think he's Apollos, and they think, I'm sorry, Paul, they think he's Apollos. They think Barnabas is Mercury. They are ready to just make them gods, too, until the apostles are quick to explain otherwise to them. So that you always have a level, you always have a level of belief by the common people, which is largely superstition. They can't articulate it, and they don't really, but it's superstition. It's like the fellow doesn't want to walk through a graveyard late at night, or who doesn't want to camp there. I've had a couple little experiences like that with good friends. You know, a cemetery is a nice place to camp at night because you, if you're really clever, you've got a ready-made place to hang your tent. But I know a lot of people wouldn't do it. They know that there are no spooks, haunts, or spirits. And in our case, if something drastic happened, it wouldn't bother us anyway. But they know that, see, but they still don't want to do it. And I only tell you that I'm not a desecrator of those things either. I just like to make fun of others. But I've known a lot that wouldn't do it. And some of them didn't feel comfortable within a quarter mile. I've actually had a couple, but we'll not get into those this hour. But see, the common man has a great sense of superstition about him, but he really doesn't believe a lot. And so even in Greece and Rome, they had a great sense of superstition, but they really didn't believe much anymore about those ancient gods. Now, what had a greater hold on the mind of the people was the occult, or what I refer to in my personal notes as the black arts. Now, the occult, or the magic practices, that had a great hold on the people. Now, greater than you'd believe, because even much of the older ancient pagan worship was associated with the occult. Determining your future by examining the liver of a couple chickens you just butchered. Sheep's liver was better. It was bigger. You could see more of the future with the sheep's liver. But the occult was very big in the ancient world. And close to the occult was the demon concepts. The demons are very much a part of it. Demonism, there were all sorts of prescriptions for casting out demons. Josephus tells us how a man cast out demons, quite apart from the Lord Jesus. Eliezer, the demon caster. Eliezer had a unique system whereby he did his best demon casting out either late in the evening or early in the morning, in which he had the individual lie prone on the ground facing the rising or setting sun, depending what the case was. So you lay on the ground, obviously, you lie on the ground facing the rising or setting sun, as the case may be, a prone position, with a saucer of water placed in front of you, just a few inches in front of you, with your head slightly elevated to watch the sun. And as the sun goes down or rises, depending on the time of the day, he stands over the victim, Eliezer does, giving incantations to drive out the demon. In time, the individual, to show the displeasure of the demon, will sneeze. You've got to think about that one for a while. He will sneeze. And in the mind of Eliezer, if all the water was blown out of the dish, the demon had left. The dish was undisturbed, the demon was still there. You have to think about that for a while. You lie and watch the sun in a funny position, you will sneeze too. You won't even need Eliezer to help you. You might sneeze four or five times, but whether you blow the water out of the dish or not is kind of a difficult thing. But the occult had a big grip on the minds of the people, a big grip on it. I will not elaborate on that, I think. I have mentioned on my notes to Sheila Hager the other day, the personalized deities is the third aspect. The worship of emperors and thinkers, the personalized deities. That's the third thrust in the religious background. The occult had a big hold. Personalized deities had some hold. The worship of emperors. The emperor worship was, it's hard for me to express it accurately. I know how to say it overly simplified, but it's hard to express it accurately. See, the idea was not that the emperor was a god while he lived, but that he became a god on his death. Consequently, you still worshiped him while he lived because he was going to be a god someday. So you actually worshiped him while he was alive, although the exact moment of his becoming a god would be when he died. Can you follow that? See, to speak of a god dying, only modern theologians who are touched do that. But to speak of a god dying is difficult. And consequently, the Roman philosophers and the Roman emperors, a man who's dying and getting weaker and weaker can still hardly think of himself as pertaining eternal life powers. But at the time of his death, he would be elevated to the pantheon. Consequently, you would worship him all the time he was emperor because he's going to be God someday. You better be good to him. That's overly simplified, but that's the general thrust in it. The worship of personalities. And the last thing I'll mention in religious background were the mystery religions. The mystery religions, which also, along with the so-called occult, had a great grip on the people. Mystery religions are a little different than the occult. They kind of go hand in hand sometimes, but they're a little different. The mystery religion usually features special ceremonies and special knowledge. And the special veneration of particular signs. The mother and child sign is a big thing in many mystery religions. We think that that is a counterfeit to Christianity, because almost anything that's good will have a counterfeit to it. I think. I even have a wooden nickel, and the nickel isn't worth much anymore. But the thrust is that the mystery religions concentrated on sacred ceremonies and on sacred ritual, not so much on the occult itself. Although they often ran hand in hand, and the sacred ritual might easily lend itself to a seance. In the mystery religions, a great deal was made of signs and symbols, passwords. The mystery religions today, let's see who I can offend in one breath. I better swallow my coffee before I do it. The mystery religions today are better represented by the Masonic lodges, probably, than by any other single group in the world, in our Western world. With the symbols and the formula and the royal arch and the trowel. And the brotherhood, the fatherhood, and yet the mysterious elevation of degree and right. Right.
Weren't the Christians sometimes mixed with these possibilities because they used the sign of the fish?
Yes, the Christians, of course, in Greece, the sign of the fish was big in Rome. But in Greece, it was almost never used, or Asia Minor, because the pagans worshipped the dolphin. So in Greece, not Athens proper, it had been under Rome so long nobody cared. But in the Greek and states of Bithynia, the cross, the gnarled cross, you know, the cross with the knobs on it, was the dominant sign, more than the fish. The fish was big in Rome. But in Asia Minor, drawing a fish was to make yourself a worshiper of that sea god, of Neptune and his dolphin. And he had not been known much in Rome that way. So the fish sign was not used much in the Christian East, but it was used very widely in the Christian West. And you are right in this area, that in a lot of times Christianity is a phenomenal religion, and there is a certain mystery to it, and there are certain rituals to it. So some Christians easily became embroiled in mystery shades of religion. You'll yet find today Christians involved in it. Today, in addition to things like the Masonic Order, the Rosicrucians are a mystery religion. You're familiar with that name? The Christophers, the Rosicrucians. There are a bunch of them that are mystery religions. They concentrate on the mysterious and the ritual. Generally speaking, not good. Not good. Not good. There are mysteries in Christianity. There are mysteries in science. There are even mysteries in crossword puzzles. 7-letter abbreviation for ohm. Well, don't worry too much about it. Yeah, so the fact that the thing has a mystery in it does not make it a mystery religion. That it is made mysterious and secretive is what does it. Now, those are the four strains of religion in the world of the New Testament age. The great problematic ones, and you'll quickly see this in the book of Acts, for the mystery religions and the occult. In Acts, there's a confrontation with the philosophers a time or two, and a confrontation with the Diana people once. But there are several confrontations with the occult and the mystery-type groups through the girl who chases the visions and who sees and predicts and that sort of thing. So you will discover that those particular religious forms had a great hold on the people. They still have a great drawing power for the people. There's something that draws the imagination of many men towards the occult. Even sometimes men, it's just hard to say. It's somewhat like the truth. It has a drawing power that hits the total spectrum. So you'll find great scientists like Sir Oliver Lodge sitting at the seance board trying to talk with his great mother, and very, very keen speculative thinkers like Conan Doyle sitting next to him wondering what his brother Charlie is doing. And down the road from them, some guy that only sold apples yesterday, and that sort of thing. So there's a great drawing power. But those are religious influence in the New Testament world, apart from Judaism, which I make a separate category. Judaism, of course, is the big one. I make it Arabic 4 in my sign here the other day. Arabic 4, the Jewish culture. The Jewish culture. Listen, it's hard to do it. It's hard to do it, but somehow in your mind, without becoming prejudicial or pejorative, that's Mr. Dunsweiler's favorite word. I still am not sure I use it rightly, but without becoming prejudicial or pejorative, somehow in your mind, you have to be able to make a distinction between the Judaism of the Lord's day and the Hebrew culture of the Old Testament, or the worship culture of the Old Testament. They are not the same thing. The Judaism of the Lord's day had become a far cry from the worship system of the Old Testament. You will discover that in the readings of the rabbis, if you wish, and they're available to you through the Talmudic tractates. In our library, we have both the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud, the two major Talmudic productions of the Jewish culture. There are a couple others, but these are the major ones, the Babylonian and the Jerusalem Talmud. The Babylonian Talmud we have in its most recent publication form. It's in English, you'll be glad to know, translated. But in its most recent publication form in 32 volumes. I didn't count them. I just know where they are and know what's in them. Know what's in a couple of them. The Jerusalem Talmud we have in its published form of about 50 years ago. Whether it has been republished recently or not, I don't know. But we have it, and we have the Babylonian Talmud, and we have the shorter editions of the Talmud by Danby and Richardson and others. The Talmud is fascinating reading. It's the kind of stuff you get reading. And of course, it's not like a continuous book. It just says, and Rabbi so-and-so asked, could you put salt in your fish, or was that confusing the diet? And so Rabbi this said, no, if you put salt in the fish, if it was iodized, it was bad. If it was not iodized, it was all right. Rabbi so-and-so said just the opposite. And another rabbi said, well, if there was pepper mixed with it, it was good. You understand I'm making that up, don't you? But that's how it goes, the Talmud. And what is the opinion on how far a man can walk on the Sabbath? Well, if he's going home because he just 1,001 ideologies. But in Hillel and Akiva, in Hillel and Akiva and Nashon, you have the primary rabbis of the Lord's day, and slightly earlier. And in reading their discussions of theological practices and prayers and whatnot, you'll quickly see that the Judaism of New Testament times is a long way from the worship practices of the Old Testament. Now, where did Peter get the idea that you couldn't eat with the Gentiles, referred to in Galatians? You don't really find it in the Old Testament. You don't find it anywhere in the... that you can't sit down at the table and eat with them. There's a dietary code in the Old Testament, but that you can't eat with the Gentiles. That had become a rabbinic trait. And the materials are just enormous in that. Now, in connection with that, I'll just pause for a minute. I have Mr. You have a report for me next Friday, is that right? Yeah. Mr. Weiss. Yeah. I'm just pointing now, but I know you're Weiss. That's next Friday, isn't it? Yeah, I'm looking for another volunteer, Dr. Bossard. We'll put you on the following Wednesday. That would be October the... October the 13th. What I'd like you to do is to get the book Jerusalem in the Time of Jesus by Jeremias. Jerusalem in the Time of Jesus by Jeremias. Maybe I get this written down. 13. And Jerusalem in the Time of Jesus by Jeremias. And give us a review of the chapter on the scribes. It's a fascinating book. I can think of 100 books I'd like you to read. Jerusalem in the Time of Jesus by Joachim Jeremias. Just a chapter on the scribes. If you bring us a report on the scribes, since they're a big part of the New Testament picture. Okay. If it's not in the library, see me. I'll loan you my copy. But if it's in the library, find it there. It'll keep us friends longer. Yeah. Yeah, good, good, good. I have that in a formal note here. It says, find somebody to report on scribes. But the Judaism of the New Testament is a far cry from the Old Testament worship system. And that's the big thing. Now, some people read you wrong in that, you may not be tempted that way, but I'm in no sense knocking it. I'm just telling you that that's what it was. It was in no sense the worship system of the Old Testament. Well, let's not say in no sense, but let's say that in 90% of what it did, it was not of the Old Testament.
Do you mean it was just different or that it was corrupted?
It was both different and corrupted. Now, when a thing is corrupted, then it's hard to know whether it's just altered or whether it's, you know, totally different. But the whole synagogue system, which was the heart of Judaism, is not an Old Testament institution. You know, the whole synagogue system was an accretion of good or bad. It certainly had a purpose when they founded it. But the whole synagogue system, the Knessets, the whole system is not an Old Testament institution. It was an adaptation. It's like who was it asking me about the youth work last night? Somebody said, could you have a lady heading up the youth work? And I said, you have to find that chapter in the New Testament that discusses the youth work. You'd be hard-pressed. So I'm not saying that the synagogue system itself was wrong, Mr. Dixon. I'm just saying that the whole synagogue system on which Judaism in the Lord's day was built was a non-Old Testament concept. It could have been in agreement with it, it could have been in disagreement with it, but it was an accretion of the Jews. So the Judaism of the Lord's time, vastly different than the worship system of the Old Testament. Vastly different. They still did a few things the same as we might. Yes, sir.
Why was the change so great?
I don't know, except to give you the very lame answer, the very lame and weak answer, that men are constantly changing things. Nothing stays static. And from the close of the Old Testament canon to the coming of Christ, about 400 years, I think, in which they had to go on previous knowledge and whatnot in a situation where they did not have the temple worship and did not have a pure Levitical system, and consequently, things tend to change, and they usually change for the worse rather than for the better. So I know of no other reason than that. But you can see it just in reading what the Lord says. Of course, you can go to Edersheim, you can go to the Jewish writers, or as I said a moment ago, to the Talmud, to Akibo and Hillel, and read the primary sources. You can see by just reading those and comparing them with Leviticus, Deuteronomy, and Numbers, you can see that it's a vastly different system. Vastly different. Moses had written 5 books of laws. By the time the rabbis got done, you couldn't write those 5 books on something the size of the Britannica hardly. But the rabbis didn't agree, so every rabbi had his own followers in his own school. It's a frightening thing. See? For example, the Judaism of the Sadducees in itself is vastly different than the Judaism of the Pharisees. But they are both quite different than the Old Testament. So when we talk about Judaism, it too is a growing thing. Just like the Christianity of today is somewhat variant from the Christianity of the second century, somewhat. But Judaism is even a more clear-cut picture. You've got the Old Testament worship system, you've got the Judaism of the Lord's day, you have the resultant Judaism of today. And the resultant Judaism of today is vastly different than what it was in the Lord's day. And again, I think for worse, in many cases, not better, but for worse. The systems change. The only thing that stays static is the grass over your grave. Mr. Yessi.
When Israel is gathered together again, do you think that Judaism will go back to what it was in the Old Testament?
I think that there will be a pure restitution of the Old Testament worship system in the purity of its meaning. I don't know what that means, but it sounds good. It's one of those things that sounds good. I don't think there will be a return to the to the Levitical orders per se, but I think that somehow whatever was that the pure worship sounded there or pleaded for there, because that system was made for the weakness of men, see. And here you have a whole system. You know that all the sacrifices are made for when you make a mistake on accident. If you make a mistake on purpose, you suffer for it. So your whole Leviticus 3 through 7, all those sacrifices were made for when you make a mistake. Well, I kind of have a feeling that when the kingdom is restored and Christ reigns, that the rule of righteousness will take care of those things, and those particular things will be. But I don't fully understand that picture any more than I do heaven or my own home. Yeah, I was at a conference with Aki, Milton Aki from he's over in Bristol today. Aki and I spoke at a conference together years ago. He's a good guy. I've always liked him. We suffered through some hard things together some years ago, too. I don't mean with each other. I mean we together suffered through
it. Careful what you say, because he's my pastor.
Now, you'll be glad for what I'm going to say, maybe, and maybe you won't. But he and I have been good friends for a long time, so we're at a conference together. And in the course of it, why, we had a period of questions and answers. And a young lady raised her hand for a question, and she said, "Why is it," she said, "that my parents..." And then she gave a long peroration on the ills of her parents. And she said, "They just don't understand me." And Mr. Aki, he responded quickly and humorously. He said, "I believe you." He said, "I really think." He said, "They probably don't understand." He said, "They probably don't." Now, he said, "You're wearing one earring." He said, "Why is that?" Well, she liked him. He bugged her for about 5 minutes on that. And eventually she said, "Well," she said, "I don't really know." And then Mr. Aki said, "See?" He said, "I don't think your parents do understand." He said, "You don't understand yourself, do you?" It was a good point, kind of lost in the group, but Aki and I thought it was good. And the group saw it too, that you often want total understanding in others when you don't understand yourself. It just is an irresponsible way to look at life. So we've chuckled over that many times, and I've remembered it as if it were yesterday. Several fellows turned and looked at it and said, "We don't understand either." That kind of thing. Yes, but that's how it was with Judaism. And there were three primary institutions in Judaism that gave it its force and vitality in the Lord's Day. I will mention what two of them are, and I will pass on to the others. I'm going to read to you from Josephus this morning, but I'm not reading so well. There were three primary institutions. One was the Jewish home. The Jewish home was always the center of Jewish culture, and to a large extent still is the Jewish home, largely through the celebration of the Passover on a home setting and through the observance of Shabbat or Sabbath on a home setting and through the observance of the great rituals on a home setting. Of course, the great ritual was circumcision, the institution and revitalization of the covenant. Those were all home-setting type things. Home-setting types of things. They were not done for the world. They were done for the family as teaching and object lessons. So the institution that gave Judaism vitality when they weren't allowed to meet, worship, and whatnot were the Hebrew homes. And that will tell you something about how maybe our culture has failed in some ways too. A tough time getting the gang together for 5 minute devotions. It can be done. But boy, if we had to sit down for the Passover together, I don't know what would happen. I'd wind up burning my fingers on the candles. The second Jewish institution was the temple. The temple. Now, Josephus tells us a lot about it in his Wars of the Jews in Volume 5. I was going to bring it up and read it this morning, but I didn't. So I guess you'll not be the poorer for it. I'm not that good a reader. But the temple had actually lost a lot of its prestige because Herod had defiled it. And the Sadducees ruled it. The Sadducees ruled it. And while the Sadducees were, as I will say in a few moments, a very prominent bunch of Jews, the Sadducees were not theologically acceptable to a lot of the Jewish community with their no hereafter, no angels, and their love for Greek dress. So the temple was one of the big institutions, but it had lost a lot of its influence. However, it still remained like a big sacred shrine. And many Jews, Pharisees, and others thought of the day when the temple would be purged and when it would be central again. Many looked for that day. We do not know for sure that Herod's temple was totally new. He may have used some things that were left over and parts of the buildings that were left over from Zerubbabel's temple, but it was a monstrous thing. One day this fall, I will have Mr. Packwell, I think. I haven't talked with Packwell yet, but he's a big Jerusalem authority. One day I will perhaps have Mr. Packwell lecture you all on Jerusalem in the times of Jesus with poems model. I may try that. I have my own hang-ups in life. I don't care a thing where the Tower of Antonia was, to tell you the truth. I will see if Mr. Packwell is free to do that someday, because it's interesting and instructive. But if you're in room 23 and you notice that, Dr. Cohen could not scale the hills right. You understand that, I think. But the land dimensions are quite accurate to scale. And if you'll see the enormous portion of the city area that the temple takes, that's accurate pretty much to scale. Some of you have perhaps been to Jerusalem. The temple sites take lots of room. So Herod's temple was a very elaborate thing. We've uncovered that famous inscription that warns you not to go in lest you be killed. It doesn't really say lest you be killed. It says if you get killed, it's your fault. That's what it says. If you pass beyond this point, you are responsible for your own demise. That is a crude reading of it. But that's what it amounts to. No, it was the outer court gate where the Gentiles could come this far and go no further into the sanctuary, not to the Holy of Holies, but just into the temple proper. The Gentiles could come to the outer court, they stop there. And the sign says, if you go beyond this, we will not be responsible for your resultant death. That's what it says. See, I've translated four ways out of my memory right here. But that's what, it doesn't really say thou shalt be killed. It says you'll be dead and it won't be our fault. That's what it says. Yeah. It's a strange wording. But I would have known what it meant. Yes, that's the thrust of it. The third of the institutions was the synagogue. The synagogue. Jewish rabbinists tell us, and this is a point, the history of the time of the statement is about 600 AD, so it no doubt is incorrect, so don't be too wrapped up in it. But they tell us that in Jerusalem, before the Romans ruined Jerusalem, they tell us there were 480 synagogues in Jerusalem. Don't put too much credence in it. But as all the commentators note, it would have been one at every drugstore, but as all the commentators note, if they tell us there were 480, it certainly means there were a lot, not just a few. Nobody really thinks that figure is quite right. The figure is several hundred years after the fall when it's written by the medieval Jew. But it certainly indicates that there were some. The synagogue had suddenly come into history about the time of the return from Babylon, when the Jews for many years, now that's an apparency, there's no proof in that, but that apparently is the case. When the Jews for many years did not have available the accesses of the temple, and moreover, when a lot of the Jews didn't even come back. You realize that only a fraction of the Jews returned to Jerusalem after the Babylonian captivity. You just have to stop. The biblical proof of that is found in the book of Esther, when Haman is going to kill all the Jews. That's a long time after they returned from Babylon, but they send out messages to all the provinces of the empire. Persian Empire ruling most of the civilized world. So he sends out messengers to all the provinces of the empire. You don't think he sent them out because there were no Jews there. The evidence is implicit, but the evidence is implicit that there were Jews scattered throughout the whole of the empire. And so he sends out letters to all the provincial governors to kill the Jews. Well, if they'd all been in Jerusalem, he could have saved a lot of writing. Of course, the fact that at the time, the new wife to the king and the chief advisor to the king were both Jews, and you can hardly believe they were the only Jews in the city. That's Esther and Mordecai. So no one will argue with me at that point, I don't think, especially in an enlightened group like this. But many of the Jews did not come back. I mentioned the other day the Jewish community that continued in India from about 450 B.C. until the foundation of the Jewish state in Palestine. That's a long time. Some of our Indian students had actually been there in years past. Mr. Baraga, and I don't know if Mr. Muthatil had been there or not, but the Baraga boys had both been there and seen the ancient synagogue and the scrolls and knew much about it. So because of their because of the inaccessibility of the temple, and because of the scattered nature of the Jews, the synagogue system developed as a teaching means to hold the Jews together. Synagogue, of course, means gathered together. Sunago, gathered together. And they could form a synagogue wherever they had 10 adult males, 10 household heads, 10 adult males. They needed that many for the synagogue function. And they just found them in every situation. They needed no priest at a synagogue. They needed no priest. They usually elected one of the 10 as the ruler of the synagogue. He'd be kind of a chief elder. And in time, that chief elder, I didn't think chapel had started yet, and in time, that chief elder would become the rabbi or the teacher. Rabbi from the Hebrew word ravav, meaning to be many. The term rabbi really means one of the big shots, one of the big men. The rabbi. Sounds like my choir. Don't laugh. Don't laugh. We had our choir sing here last summer. Took the house. Mr. Moses.
Before the time of the return of Babylon, there must have been something in the, didn't Elijah, for example, go make the routes around the various places in Israel and so forth? What were they?
Well, there are two things we don't know what they are. One is we don't know what the school of the prophets was. We don't have any idea what that was at all. It's referred to in Samuel's day and later in Elijah's day, too. Elijah seemed to wander through the country preaching, but he doesn't seem to have served any official teaching capacity while doing it. Elisha, his movements are a little, I get them confused easily. His movements are a little better chronicled than Elijah's. But again, he doesn't seem to have established a teaching circuit. Seems to have established some work. There could have been, though. There could have been a whole school system. There obviously was some kind of school system in Palestine. Things like the Gezer calendar suggest that to us. But whether they were synagogical or not, that's the question. Because synagogue is the idea of being gathered together for ritual practices, the recitation of prayers, the hearing of scriptures, and so forth. There's no reason to doubt that what they began as early as Ezra's time, and maybe before. Just hard to pinpoint the date on it. But sometime in that particular time, I don't know what they're showing in the chapel, but I don't think it's David and Bathsheba, so we can stay here. Yeah. Yeah, so I know the films that the Christians like to go and see. I still see, I have not returned to the theater, except the legitimate stage to see Othello. And to imagine that I'm acting the role of Iago again. Crafty. I always had a villain's role. Did it poorly, usually. You don't have to be good to be a villain, you just have to be yourself. That's the thrust of it. Now, the synagogue system, as I mentioned, founded in many parts with its ruling elders and its eldership, chiefly worked on a basis of services that were built around prayer and reading, exposition of scripture. There were daily services at most synagogues and Sabbath evening services in all synagogues. Most synagogues soon developed a school, too, where the children could, the boys, where the young men could learn to read Hebrew and presumably to write Hebrew. And other functions. Some synagogues involved trade schools. You could go there and learn how to be a brick mason. Or something like that. So those were the basic institutions. I wanted to mention small b, the religious observations. The religious observations in the Jewish culture. In a nutshell, the Jews had attempted to some extent to maintain some of the sacred ritual of the Old Testament. Tenney on page 95 gives you a list of the feasts and the special days. But they had attempted to retain some of the sacred ritual of the Old Testament. In fact, they'd retained the structure of most of it. They had simply added a lot of stuff to it. We have just recently passed through, or are we still passing through, the high holidays? Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Are we in the middle of it? Yeah, in the middle of it, moving from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur. It's hard to keep track of those things. The Jewish culture worked on two calendar system, you know. They had a civil calendar which began in the month Tishri, which is about where we're passing, Tishri. And they had a religious calendar which began in the spring, the month Nisan. It was kind of like what we have when you have a yearly calendar and a fiscal calendar. We have a fiscal calendar here at BST which never ends. Just drags on and on and on. And a yearly calendar which ends every December on the 31st. So the Jewish calendar worked. That's why the Jewish New Year was celebrated. When I was a younger Christian, it bugged me no end that the Jewish New Year was celebrated in the fall, but that the Jewish Passover, which was on the 14th day of the first month, was celebrated in the spring. I never could figure out how you could have New Year in the fall and the big high holy day on the 14th day of the first month, 7 months later. I never could figure that out. Today, as a wise professor, I know. Jewish New Year was celebrated in accordance with the legal year, and Passover was celebrated in accordance with the ceremonial year. So it kind of worked that way. And hence the New Year is actually celebrated in the seventh month, but on the legal calendar, that's the start of the whole thing. Probably it was geared to the planting seasons in Palestine originally. Probably geared to the planting and the agrarian systems. But they attempted to follow the rituals. They made a great deal of Passover, Feast of Unleavened Bread, Feast of Tabernacles. Now, for those three feasts, all the Jews came to Jerusalem, theoretically. Passover, after their own family celebration, but then for the great mass celebration, the Feast of Weeks, Unleavened Bread, and Passover and Unleavened Bread really was one seven-day feast, one eight-day cycle. And then the Feast of Weeks, 50 days later, identified with the Christian Pentecost, and the Feast of Tabernacles in Tishri. All Jews theoretically came to Jerusalem at that time, or near to it. Those religious observations were very big, and you'll see them constantly referred to in the New Testament, and we're still hung up on the date of the crucifixion because we can't be sure whether the meal they celebrated was the Passover or the preparation for the Passover. And if you think there is an easy solution to it, then, as I said a few moments ago, you are just proving that you are naive. But you may resolve it in your own mind and be satisfied. But you may not be able to satisfy the guy down the street from it. I would mention also the religious groups rather quickly. That would be small c. Small a, the institution. Small b, the religious observation. Small c, the religious groups. In Judaism. Still in Judaism. The Sadducees, without any poems or clever comments, the Sadducees, they were the priestly class in the Lord's Day in Jerusalem. They held most of the political power, and they had a big share of the wealth. But the Sadducees had been political compromisers for a long time. They were in favor of adopting the Greek games and Greek clothes. They liked to wear laurel leaves in their hair. They were in no sense representative of Old Testament religious worship, in no sense at all, other than the fact that they were children of Abraham, somewhat removed. But they had the money, and they had favor with Rome, because they compromised all issues of culture with the Grecian culture. They believed very little. The Pharisees, the article on Pharisees in the Jewish Encyclopedia is really worth anybody's reading. I can't assign it because there's only so much you're allowed to assign, but the article on Pharisees in the Jewish Encyclopedia, either the old one or the new one, is really worth reading. The Pharisees were a group who originally were the protectors of the tradition. Peretz means separated in Hebrew, Peretz. They were the separated ones. They stood apart from the Sadducees and other wicked persons. They were the guarders of the tradition, the guardians of the tradition. And consequently, 200 years before the Lord's time, they were not that bad a bunch. In fact, even in the Lord's day, no doubt the Pharisaic movement was still a model group. There were Pharisees like Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, who certainly were a cut above the ones who are condemned in Matthew 23. So it has to be noted that when the Lord speaks of a wicked Pharisee, he does not mean per se that every Pharisee was wicked. But the group had deteriorated to the point where they could donate their goods to the temple and then let their father and mother starve, see, saying, well, it belongs to the temple, Korban it is. The group had deteriorated frightfully. They were the legalists and the traditionalists, and they had the respect of the masses as being a holy person. Now, there were also a bunch of zealots who wanted to revolt and throw off the Roman rule, a bunch of political zealots. And there were also the Essene groups, of whom very little is known. Essene, E-S-S-E-N-E, zealots, E-E-A-L-O-T, or the zealots and the Essenes, of whom little is known. Although today, most scholars think that the Qumran community, Qumran is spelled Q-U-M-R-A-N, today most scholars think that the Qumran community was an Essene-type community. If that is true, some scholars don't agree with that yet, but if that's true, then today we really know quite a lot about some of the Essenes, because we know an awful lot about Qumran. Qumran is where the famous Dead Sea Scrolls were found in 1947, and where there have been continued findings of literature as recently as 1972. And maybe since then, I'm always about 3 years behind in that field. But the stuff that's been found at Qumran, you have all literary fragments found at Qumran, they would pack this room. I don't mean the floor, I mean the whole room. The whole room. Not many of them are whole scrolls. The vast majority of them are boxes of broken fragments taken from the floors of caves and scriptoriums. You say, well, how in the world did they get so many? Well, they were a bunch of literate rascals at Qumran, who over about 150 years produced, and threw stuff away like mad, didn't burn it or bury it. They apparently threw it in old caves. Now, the famous scrolls found in 1947 have gotten the press because they were just beautiful manuscripts. But the cave, the fragments dug out of more recent caves, out of Cave 4 and Cave 11, and from Wadi Murabat and from Bar Kokhba's time and whatnot, it's just exciting stuff, and it'll be 100 years, I would think, till all the stuff is arranged and put in order. Maybe not even then. And maybe they'll do it faster. They've been trying to put computers to work on it. It's hard to program a computer to work at it. That's the hard thing, because here you've got 1,000 fragments, each with 3 letters on them. If there were some quick programming thing to know which 3 letters went with what 3 letters, you might do it faster. I'm not an authority in those fields. I listen to authorities tell me the complexities, and I think that my life is pretty easy after that. But from Qumran, we have the manual of discipline, we have the rules for their grouping. We just know an awful lot about Qumran, an awful lot. We know that there were men and women there, they buried them in different cemeteries. Why? That we don't know. The female skeleton is distinctly different than the male skeleton, they tell me. I'm not much of an authority on the skeleton, but the shape of the hips and whatnot, they say, identify them rather quickly. I'm not much of an authority on skeletons, living or dead. But anyhow, I'm told that. Now, here's the funny thing. Many Jews did not belong to any of these groups. I used to feel you had to be one of the groups. But the vast majority of the Jews were just people like you and I are. How's that? Of course, the Pharisees had the same kind of blood. If you shot them, they bled and so forth. But the vast majority of the Hebrew people belonged to no party. They were ruled at the temple by the Sadducees, ruled in their private devotions by the Pharisees, and constantly mystified by the Essenes, who said things are bad here and getting worse. The vast majority of the Jews were just common people moving around who belonged to no party. Mr. Yeske.
You
can tell
the
I'm sorry, Jeske.
Who were the Herodians?
The Herodians were a group of semi-zealots who favored a merger of the forces of Herod and Rome. They were kind of reverse zealots. Favored the Romanization of the Jewish empire, or of the Jewish state, the Palestinian state.
They were Jews.
They were Jews and Idumeans. Idumea was the territory from which Herod came from, and mostly they were thought to be Idumean Jews.
And the Hellenists were Greeks?
The Hellenists were really Jews who had adopted Greek cultures very thoroughly. Some of the Hellenists may have been Greek proselytes. Tenney has a nice paragraph on the Hellenists and the Hebraists. Mm-hmm. Right.
Did the Zealots or the
Herodians have any particular religious positions, or is that almost just political?
They were political. They were political action groups. They had about as much of a religious position as the Jewish Defense League has. Not as much. So I have some papers I want to pass out because I got them here today and I won't have them here tomorrow. I won't have you either. But these are ahead of us. You see, it's only a matter of time in any of my courses till I begin to produce stuff. I largely begin to produce it when I feel that I'm not going to have enough time to cover what I want to. And I want to make you responsible for it, so I begin producing it. It's only a matter of time. And it may interfere with your notes, and it may not. It's a calculated risk. But if you'll take one and pass the rest of the stack to Mrs. Platika, she'll take one and pass the rest of it to her husband, who will take one, and so forth. Yeah, that's right. These are unnumbered syllabus sheets. They might stop at any point, but I'm looking ahead, see, and I'm thinking of all the stuff I want to get in the course, and realizing that I will never do it by oral discussion. I tell too many stories. But consequently, I resort to printed materials, which in effect obligate you about that. And I will say something about it, too, likely. So take one and pass it on, and then...
Is this right, unnumbered?
Did you say unnumbered?
Unnumbered,
yeah. If I do it, anything is right. If I do it, anything is right.
Get it done.
Can
we take that attitude and paper?
Yeah, for me, even take that attitude and papers. Get it done. Don't bring me the paper a week late saying, well, I was trying to make sure all the periods were right. Don't do it. I will immediately think you were a dunce. So when you pick up these pages, you're free to flee. Free to flee. And I will see you on Wednesday.